I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Some mosques and Muslim community centers throughout Pennsylvania took extra security measures during the holiday of Ramadan, in most cases engaging police or private security during evening services. Though Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty reports in Lancaster County, a handful of residents took it upon themselves to keep an eye on things.
I arrived at the Islamic Center of Lancaster on a balmy Sunday night and was greeted by a white, middle-aged woman named Ann Wanger. She said she'd been spending three evenings a week in the parking lot of the center during Ramadan, usually joined by one or two of the half-dozen other volunteers she found through Facebook. The small group's calling itself the Tranquility Force.
When they're inside, when they're gathered as a community, when they're gathered for prayer or for their meal, they don't have to worry about what's happening out here. They don't have to worry that someone might be coming in and hiding behind the bushes, or someone might be coming in and vandalizing their cars, or, you know, lying in wait for them. They know that we're here.
I was there for community iftar, which is the meal that Muslims eat after sundown every night of Ramadan to break the daily fasts that are required of healthy adults during the month-long Islamic holiday. And on this particular evening, the community iftar included a church whose pastor had invited me to observe the interfaith activity. After the initial prayers and dinner, I spoke with Fariha Sarij about Wanger's presence in the parking lot outside. She told me Wanger reached out in advance of nationwide demonstrations by the anti-Muslim activist group ACT for America, including one at the state capitol, about a half an hour away.
I think it was just because of that march that was happening. They were just kind of afraid. And there's things going on around the country that we hear about. And we haven't felt any kind of threats or anything that we should be concerned about.
Others say they do worry. Atufa Akbar, an artist who helps her husband run their carry-out halal restaurant just outside the city of Lancaster, says she's anxious about misperceptions of their entire community based on news coverage and political rhetoric surrounding extremist groups.
Every time, you know, if there's a bad thing going on in the community or in the world, they get scared. Like, if I hope it's not a Muslim, I hope, like, seriously, that's the biggest fear we have about it.
That's part of what Wanger says when she talks about why she's here, to show support and maybe give people peace of mind while they're praying together. As a therapist, Wanger sees the emotional toll of recent public discourse frequently in her clients from all walks of life.
I don't have any clients who are Muslim. I have clients who are people of color in the LGBTQ community, immigrants. So I've seen more fear, more trepidation, definitely. A lot of resignation in a way. It hasn't been all that shocking to see the level of visible expressed hate rising, but it still is deeply disappointing.
The Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, issued a security advisory a couple weeks ago, citing recent violence and threats against Muslims in London, Portland, and Virginia. But some Muslim communities in Pennsylvania decided months ago to bolster security during Ramadan. Rizwan Butt is president of the Easton Phillipsburg Muslim Association.
We're always concerned about security in general of people coming and going that late at night, especially when there's families and children involved. But over the past couple of years, we've been extra careful. And this year specifically, we actually hired a private security company.
CARE also tracks non-criminal bias incidents against Muslims as well as hate crimes. Its 2017 report noted a spike nationally over the last couple of years, similar to the rise in anti-Islamic hate crimes documented by uniform crime reports kept by the FBI.
Even though we live in a relatively safe area and people know us, a verbal altercation, a physical altercation, or some type of a terror attack against a mosque, all those things are possible things that can happen based on the political climate.
In Pennsylvania, there were 8 anti-Islamic hate crimes in 2015. That's the most since 2001, the year of the September 11th terrorist attacks. But then last year, it dropped down to 2, which is about average for the past 2 decades. On the non-criminal side, nearly half of religion-based discrimination cases handled by the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission have involved bias against Muslims, more than any other religious group. But Ann Wanger, the woman who greeted me at the community center, says it was an incident in Ohio that moved her to action. a Muslim woman was hospitalized for injuries sustained during a brawl at an apartment complex, although police haven't arrested anyone and aren't investigating the incident as a hate crime, because they say there are conflicting reports about what happened.
I've seen those pictures, the bruises on her face, her jaw was broken, she was unconscious. I just felt like I had to do something. So this is a place where I can be. I can know, okay, during Ramadan, these people will be here, and I can be here, not because there's an expectation that something violent will happen, but if something were to happen, we are here. We are watching, we are witnessing, we are being a force for tranquility.
Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY serves as the lead station. In a surprise development, Seth Williams ended his corruption trial today by pleading guilty. Williams, no longer Philadelphia's district attorney, will await his October sentencing hearing from a federal jail cell in Center City. WHYY's Bobby Allen, who's been in the courtroom covering the case, has more.
Everyone in the courtroom knew something was up. The day's witness wasn't on the stand. The jury hadn't come out. For more than an hour, prosecutors and defense lawyers were conferring and exchanging papers and whispering in huddles. Then the judge walked in. He announced that Seth Williams pleaded guilty to one count of bribery, punishable up to 5 years in prison. 28 other charges would be dismissed, though the two-term DA had to admit to the underlining facts of them. The judge ordered Williams immediately arrested, telling the court, quote, "I am appalled by the evidence I heard. I do not believe him." Neither did federal prosecutor William Fitzpatrick.
Mr. Williams sold his office in exchange for a corrupt stream of benefits. It's unfortunate. It's sad. It's a betrayal of the trust that the people placed in him. But today, Mr. Williams was held accountable.
When asked why now, Williams' defense lawyer Thomas Burke said the time just felt right after seeing 7 days of damning and at times embarrassing testimony about Williams.
It's obviously a very sad day for him and his family. He has tendered his resignation in the courtroom as district attorney. That is being forwarded to the mayor's office. This was a very hard decision for a proud man.
The lead prosecutor on the case, U.S. Attorney Bob Zosmer, said the government had offered Williams this very deal weeks before the trial, but he rejected it. Zosmer was notified at 1 a.m. that Williams changed his mind and wanted to take the deal and end his trial.
This is not something that just happened in the last few hours. He was aware of it, and he and his counsel had a good deal of time to consider it.
Zosmer says the feds only found out about Williams taking bribes and stealing from his mother and political action committee when looking into something else. Lamborghini-driving Bucks County businessman Muhammad Ali, who was under investigation for money laundering.
It was during that investigation that the Homeland Security official saw contacts with Seth Williams on Mr. Ali's cell phone.
Then the FBI and IRS put real muscle into it, and Williams was indicted on bribery, extortion, and fraud charges. Zosmer said this is not the first time he's won a public corruption case in Philadelphia.
Former Congressman Ed Mezvinsky, the City Hall corruption case involving former City Treasurer Corey Kemp, former State Senator Vincent Fumo.
That said, he says he wishes he didn't have to, especially for the thousands of honest public servants in the city and state.
It's unfortunate that periodically we have to gather like this and address corruption in the city and in the state of Pennsylvania.
Williams' replacement will be chosen by a panel of Philadelphia judges. Whoever is selected will be replaced by the winner of the November general election, where Democrat Larry Krasner and Republican Beth Grossman are on the ballot. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
In the world of higher education, 1 + 1 = 1. Philadelphia University and Thomas Jefferson University are merging. Helping to explain the new math is Dr. Stephen Klasko, president of Thomas Jefferson University, and Dr. Stephen Spinelli, president of Philadelphia University. Dr. Klasko, Dr. Spinelli, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
It's great to be on.
Yeah, we're thrilled. Big day for us.
Tell us more about the win-win. What was the impetus for the merger?
Well, the fact is that higher education has been going through traumatic and dramatic change. And the value proposition has not kept up with the needs of society. Thomas Jefferson and Philadelphia University both saw that happening, focused very heavily on professional education, elevating it to leadership position, and coming together with the same mentality that we have to be market-facing and that we have to be thinking about the future, not about the past. There was a real commonality about how we believed education should go forward. And what we had a couple of dates, and it turned into a marriage.
Well, and I think, you know, what we're creating today will be a total university to a no-limits approach to the future of higher education. So I believe we're going through this nexus where, if you look 10 years from now, the value equation, as Steve put it, in higher education, what it costs versus the customization, the flexibility of a degree, will be 100% changed.
At first glance, this seems as cumbersome as the Brundle fly, where a university with roots in textiles wants textile colleges meeting a school renowned in the health sciences.
On the surface, it would seem that way. On the surface, you'd say health science university and design university, like, are you kidding? But actually, it was just the opposite. When you look at what Steve's vision was and our vision, which was to reimagine healthcare education, discovery to create unparalleled value, and you realize what's happened with Philadelphia University, you actually saw two really, frankly, senior by age universities that were acting like startup companies in very different ways, us in healthcare, them in design, architecture in the built environment, engineering and commerce. So it really did start like a match.com. I mean, we had a 15-minute conversation that was supposed to be obligatory. An hour and a half later, we left and said, all right, well, we definitely want to start dating, and then what's the next step? And it was like that television show Married at First Sight.
Was it speed dating? How far back was that 15-minute conversation and to the present?
Well, it was almost a year, almost 2 years ago that we had the first conversation, but the affinity was almost immediate. The regulatory hurdles presented a greater challenge, but that all happened too. And what that provided us was a period of time to really begin to understand how we can take vision and passion and make it a business model and a reality in a transformed university. So we've been using that time to do great things.
What are some of the obvious differences that students will notice now?
They're going to see Philadelphia in a different way. They're going to have the suburban-like atmosphere of East Falls and the intensity of Center City. They're going to see a university with 50% undergraduate and 50% graduate and easier pathways between those, blurring the lines of the traditional hurdles in credentialing and finding a quicker pathway to their major and their passion. They're going to see research opportunities that really looks through the lens of the marketplace.
I mean, if I could summarize it, we're going to make education more flexible, more customized, less expensive, more technology-driven, and frankly, more fun. And, you know, I think a big part of what we both agree is that we need to start creating the people that will be needed for the jobs of the future, not the jobs of today and yesterday. We have something at Jefferson, our most successful new venture has been the Institute for Emerging Health Professions. What jobs are going to be needed 10 years from now that don't even exist today?
You said at the onset that the catalyst for the merger in part was in response to the evolving, if not revolving, business of higher education. Do you see these mergers as a trend taking place in other major cities, for example?
Well, I see consolidation in higher education absolutely coming. Obviously, I think that a merger of this nature and an ability to combine the core competencies and special competencies of two universities that have a common vision about elevating the professional life, that leads toward a merger and I think a better end result. But I think you're going to see all kinds of consolidation across America.
And frankly, what's already happened is people are calling us. You know, I mean, the same thing happened in our healthcare side. There had been very little consolidation in Philadelphia. And when we merged with Abington, other people started to come forward. I think there's going to be such a compelling vision. And I think that a lot of the smaller places will start to say, is there a way for us to get involved in this kind of very exciting new model?
The ways in which we are going to do this blending or blurring of the lines is still evolving, but I think it's a big trend in higher education that you don't have to do everything yourself, that you can create an ecosystem. And part of this whole ecosystem, in referenced by Dr. Klasko in the larger enterprise, is that we have lots of partners that we're going to leverage and be able to provide that kind of customization. We don't have to own everything. We have to do a lot, but we don't have to own a lot. And that's part of where consolidation is going.
Dr. Klasko, Dr. Spinelli, congratulations. Thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Stephen Klasko, president of Thomas Jefferson University, and Dr. Stephen Spinelli, president of Philadelphia University. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.